Beyond the standard model means explaining what is the origin of the universe maps. And that means both visible and dark energy. For some people, beyond the standard model means I'm going to explain what is the matter, antimatter, asymmetry in the universe. If you want the mere fact that we are made up of matter and there is no antimatter around, well, it's a mystery, and this is what beyond the standard model sometimes tries to explain. For me, beyond the standard model is the future of particle physics. But it's mostly lots of fun. It is fun. This is the reason why we are here doing particle physics. It's not because we want to understand this small parameter to a very high precision. It's because we want to solve these very fundamental questions that, you know, relate to the origin of the universe. How is that matter and antimatter are treated so differently? How we ended up having dark matter and visible matter, and all these questions that we just don't understand. So first thing I have to say is that, you know, the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, is running. And it's going to keep running at 70 eV for yet another 2 years, until the end of 2012. So many people think that the LHC is equals discovering the Higgs particle. That's probably what you heard more often, right? The LHC will discover the Higgs particle. That's wrong, because you have to remember that particle physics is not the same as a stamp collection. Right? We just don't go spend $8 billion in building a machine to find one particle. Because particle physics is not about particles, it is about the principles that lie behind the existence of these particles. It's about principles in terms of symmetries and in terms of mechanisms. And this is where particle physics is interesting. This is where particle physics makes a connection with any other type of physics, because the principles that, you know, regulate the way the Higgs behaves or the electrons or neutrinos behave are, in fact, light on symmetries and mechanisms. And these symmetries may show up in other areas of physics. For example, breaking of symmetries that shows up in particle physics shows us also in condensed matter. Okay. So now I say these words. I tell you what is the outline of the course. We are going to talk about a bunch of stuff, okay? And we are going to touch every aspect of beyond the standard model. So it's going to be a fast-paced course. It's going to be kind of hand-waving many times. But I want you to stop me at any point, and I'm very happy spending time explaining something deeper, okay? It's just because I want to give you a big overview of all the aspects of beyond the standard model that is going to be like kind of fast. So the first thing we'll do is to set where is the evidence for beyond the standard model. Evidence comes from data, from experiments. So we will talk about what experiment is telling us about the need for beyond the standard model. Then we'll talk about what is the rationale for beyond the standard model. What are the reasons why we think the standard model kind of stinks? There is something wrong in the standard model, and there is a rationale to believe that there is beyond the standard model. And then we will talk about data. and how data already give us a lot of guidance in terms of what is the possibilities for the standard, beyond the standard model. And once I set up all these things, we will jump into the different beyond the standard model proposals. Those will be supersymmetry, and I will write SUSY every time. It will be Technicolor, and I will write a TC, Technicolor, and extra dimensions. And I will do something like Xtheme, right? Just because I'm lazy. All right, so you don't have any more questions, suggestions, complaints? I'll just move into the evidence for beyond the standard model. So let's do this part. There are many questions out there that in principle could be explained using particle physics. But we have to sit down and think which questions are addressable by particle physics. Questions that for sure have something to do with particle physics are, what is dark matter? What is called baryogenesis? Baryogenesis is the matter-antimatter asymmetry in the universe. It's just a fancy name saying generating baryons versus generating antibaryons. So why there is matter and there is no antimatter? How do you generate matter? And the last question is neutrino masses. These three solid pieces of evidence that there is beyond the standard model are very important, and we are going to go through each of them. So let's start with dark matter. You've probably seen this pie chart of the universe, where we have this guy here, around 4% of the universe is things we know is the standard model of particle physics. About 25%, 23% of the universe is what is called dark matter. And actually, and it's a recent discovery, most of our universe, the weighting energy of our universe is composed by dark energy. So about 70% of the universe is dark energy. And if you want, most of the universe is dark, meaning we don't know what is this, dark energy or dark matter. So you may ask, okay, is dark energy something we can address using particle physics? The answer is I don't know, and I don't think anybody knows. Whereas we do know that dark matter should be something we can address in particle physics. So we are going to try to explain this piece of the pie chart, 25% of the universe, and for the moment close our eyes and forget about dark energy. Okay, so what do we know about dark energy? Dark matter. Using a lot of data, including the Ballet cluster, or WMAP, or other things, we know that most probably dark matter is a particle. And because it's not a particle that we know already about, it's a new particle. So it's ground for new physics. So dark matter is a new particle. All right, so let's talk about this new particle. What do we know besides that it's new? Well, we know it is heavy. It is there, and it's weighting a lot, so it must be heavy. Yes? It could be several particles. For the moment, we will take the approach of one particle. Yeah, the dark matter Instead of dark matter particle, you could think about dark matter sector that will contain a lot of particles. More questions? Good questions, please. So it is heavy because it's not visible, it doesn't interact with light, so it is electrically neutral. And what else we know? Well, we know that it's still, so it's stable. So, because it is heavy, it has been produced in the very early universe. So we are going to have to talk about the early universe. Because it's neutral, well, that's why we call it dark. We know it doesn't have an electric charge. That's what makes it nice. And it is stable because it's still there. There is a caveat though. It could be that the dark matter particle decays, but it takes a very, very long time. So there is still a lot of dark matter particles around, but they are actually decaying. But for this discussion, we will assume that dark matter is a stable particle. Yes? So from all this data, we have a lot of information about the couplings of the dark matter particle to standard model particles. So I'm going to show you some constraints from direct and indirect detection. It has to be weakly coupled to the standard model particles. So now, this particle has to be stable. And this stability is going to play a very important role in setting up models for beyond the standard model. How do we make this particle that is heavy, stable? Because it is heavy and it couples to other particles, why is not decaying to other light standard model particles? Kinematically, it is allowed to decay. So there must be a symmetry reason why this heavy particle that may couple to the standard model is not decaying into the standard model. This stability will play a very important role later. Okay. We also know a little bit more from the dark matter particles. For example, from direct detection experiments. You probably heard about CPMS or xenon. They are experiments that you put underground with a lot of targets and weights. And you wait and wait and wait, hoping for a dark matter particle to hit a nuclei and see the recoil. So from direct detection experiments, we have a lot of constraints, and I will show some of them. And there is also a bit of constraints from what is called indirect detection. Indirect means that dark matter particle could annihilate with itself and produce electron positron or photon photon. So using this kind of the products of the annihilation, you may set bounds on the dark matter particle, and they are called indirect bounds. Because it's not really the dark matter particle hitting something, but it's the product of the annihilation of dark matter. So we have a lot of information. All right, and this information is on the mass of this particle and on the couplings of this particle to the standard model. So now we want to talk about a particle that has been produced in the early universe. So we need to talk a little bit about the early universe. All right, so from WMAP mostly, we know that the contribution of dark matter particles times some stupid constant that is order 0.7, this is equal to 0.11 with a very small error. So we know the content of dark matter of the universe to a very high precision. This is thanks to the collected data of WMAP. WMAP collects data on the cosmic microwave background, photons that are lying around.
Sorry.
Yes.
What is omega and what is A?
Okay, I'm going to do that. So omega, dark matter, it is the energy density of dark matter over what is called the critical energy density. And I'm going to explain what is the energy density. The point is that this guy is actually the density of dark matter particles now, the mass of the particle divided this guy, rockets. So to understand what is the content of dark matter in the universe, we need to know what is the mass of the particle and what is the density of those particles that are around. So first, I need to explain what is this particle density. And you need to, I don't know if you've done some cosmology of any kind. Perfect. So remember in the early universe, you had to talk, or the simplest way of talking about what's going on is using the Kolmogorov volume picture. So what it means is, let's say T equals T1. I take a couple of particles, or galaxies, or whatever you want, and I enclose them by a volume V1. Now, if I just follow what's going on in the universe is expanding, the geometry itself is expanding, so if I let some time pass, a T equals T2 bigger than T1, what I'm going to see is that these two particles seem to have displaced respect to each other. So now they occupy a larger volume, and they seem to be farther apart. Is that because the two particles experience any kind of force? No, it's just because the geometry is expanding itself. So to account for this expansion of the universe, you just follow a volume. So I want to describe physics in this volume, and I just keep following the volume V2 as the universe expands. So the idea of the Kolmogorov volume is to try to take off what is the effect of the expansion of the universe and just account for the real physics. And the way to do that is to always talk on properties inside a Kolmogorov volume. Yes?
Sorry, about the energy density. Is the reason why the dark matter particle cannot be relativistic? Is that M the mass?
We are assuming that it's heavy, right? So it's probably non-relativistic at this time. And there is another reason. Dark matter could be, years ago, dark matter could have been neutrinos. Right? So, really, relativistic particles. But this is what is called hot dark matter, or warm dark matter, and this is not working out well. So the reason is that if you have a lot of relativistic particles still around, like neutrinos, and you had a bunch of them, you will kind of harm the structure formation. So you have a bunch of relativistic particles around, there won't be so much a structure as we see now. So dark matter is probably non-relativistic right now. It's called dark matter. So, but then instead of describing energy of number of particles, what we describe is energy density, which is the energy per Kolmogorov volume, and the number of particles, number density, which is the number of particles per Kolmogorov volume. And that's the right description. So now, I said that we need to obtain this guy to describe what is the content of dark matter of the universe. What is the physics that affects the particle density? The physics can be described using the Boltzmann equation. What it says is, the variation with time of the particle density is something that has to do with just the expansion of the universe, where h is just the Hubble constant. So let me know you understand every concept here. I'm not sure what you've seen of cosmology so far. Minus, and this is the important part, the particle density squared minus the equilibrium density multiplied by the cross section of annihilation of the dark matter particle times the velocity. And this means thermal averaged. So the dark matter particles are diluted just because the geometry is expanding, but also there is an effect because dark matter annihilates. So if dark matter doesn't talk to anybody, this term won't be here. If dark matter can create or be destroyed by other particles, this term is going to push this term from being away from the equilibrium distribution. So you want these interactions bring the dark matter densities out of equilibrium. They want to bring them out of equilibrium. And this is the Boltzmann equation. So this is the equation we had to look at when we want to describe the density of dark matter particles now, which is what we observe. Right? Okay. This is great because here we have particle physics. This is where we can say something. And this is where we are going to obtain information about dark matter. This is the things we know how to do. Cross sections are fine. That's something we can do. So we need to obtain this.
I think there must be questions about what
Yes. That's the... do you know what a cross section is? The cross section is just the rate of interaction. How fast the particle, the dark matter particle, is created or destroyed. And this is the velocity of the dark matter particle. So you know, if you have a thermal distribution of particles, they will have a Boltzmann, for example, Boltzmann distribution of velocities. So what you do is you have an annihilation cross section multiplied by that velocity distribution and then take a thermal average of that.
So that's a sigma cross section.
Yes, a sigma. Sigma cross section. Because, thank you. Good, good
student. Is it two cross sections or what kind of cross section?
Right, so that's what we are going to do now.
Okay.
This is the business for that, for particle physicists. On the other hand, knowing what is the velocity distribution of dark matter particles in our vicinity is kind of hard. But at least this part, we know how to do. So let's do that. All right. So what is that dark matter evolution? This is what we want to know. We want to produce dark matter at some point. We want to follow what is going on with dark matter, and we want to see at the end of the day now what is the quantity of dark matter, the density going around of dark matter. What we know for sure is that at very large temperatures, when the temperature was much higher than the dark matter mass, then this guy was really relativistic. He behaved as a relativistic species, meaning that the density of energy was going as the temperature to the fourth, sorry, whereas the number density was going at the temperature. So you see, at very large temperatures, at very high temperatures, then the mass, the energy density and the particle density doesn't care so much about the dark matter particle itself. It's just set by the temperature. Now, so if we have a dark matter particle, they are relativistic, happy going around, and at some point the universe expands so much that the dark matter particle becomes non-relativistic. So at T much less than the dark matter particle, this is a non-relativistic species. And at that point, the energy density is just exponentially decaying. So it goes as the mass of the particle times the particle density. And if you remember, that's what we just wrote before. So we say the density of dark matter particles goes as the particle density times the mass. That's just because we are assuming that it's a non-relativistic species. And how does this guy look like? It goes as mt to 3 halves some factor. But what is important is that it's exponentially decaying mass over temperature. What it means is that at very high temperatures, the fact that, let's say, I can produce a dark matter particle, interact with another dark matter particle, and produce standard model particles, they really don't care about how heavy is dark matter particle. It can go either way, here or here. I can either annihilate dark matter particles and produce a standard model, or vice versa. Those two processes are in thermal equilibrium, because it really costs no effort to produce this. The temperature is so high, the energy around is so high, the mass of the dark matter particle is not that important. But at some point, these guys are so heavy compared with the energy, typical energy around, that the only way to go is dark matter, goes to a standard model, in this direction only. So when that happens, it means that the dark matter particle is just disappearing every time. And the way it disappears is with this exponential decay. So at very low temperatures, there is no density. There's a very low density of dark matter particles. So this story is okay if you're just thinking about particles that don't have any interaction. If you set sigma v to zero. So now you take the Boltzmann equation, plug back these interactions, and we are going to have a very different story. So let's plot these two things. What we want to describe is the density of dark matter particles. And we want to do that in terms of, for example, this x equals the mass over the temperature, because this is a relevant quantity. So at very high temperatures, when this guy is very small, it just looks as t cubed, it's a constant. Whereas at very low temperatures, then we have this exponential decay. So if that was the end of the story, there wouldn't be any dark matter particle around. The density would be almost zero. But this is not the end of the story. The reason that, so this is when this diagram, dark matter, standard model, can go in both directions. This area is when the dark matter particle can only annihilate. But there is something interesting going on. At some point, let's say I have this volume. There are dark matter particles, and there is the standard model particles, and they are hitting each other, and everything is in thermal equilibrium. And that's what I'm describing right now. If everything is in thermal equilibrium, then you will have this, and then exponential decay. But if the expansion in the universe is very rapid, let's say this is when the rate of dark matter interactions is bigger than the expansion of the universe. But when the rate falls behind the expansion of the universe, then the dark matter particles don't have a simple way of seeing what's going around. So if the expansion goes very fast and there are very, very few dark matter particles to interact, then we call this situation, when the rate is below the expansion of the universe, we call it freeze out. If these dark matter particles kept talking to the thermal bath, they would just exponentially decay. But what saves the day is that the expansion of the universe at some point overcomes the rate of interactions. So the dark matter particle stops seeing what's going on in the thermal bath. So the universe becomes transparent to the matter particles. So instead of just going exponential like this, what we get is a distribution of freeze out that is constant. So time evolves that matter particles don't talk to anybody, they just continue in the same moving volume going like this. So this is the freeze out. And this is what is going to give us what is the relic density of that matter now. Okay, I went very fast. Any questions?
So what determines the X?
Going to that. All right. So what determines the freeze out is the rate of interaction. So this thing we can compute in particle physics. The cross section of interaction. Yeah. All right. So the idea is if your dark matter particle has a very lot of interactions with the medium, then there will be a lot of annihilations before freeze out. So what it means is that you will get different distributions for freeze out for different values of the cross section, annihilation cross section. And the way it goes is that if the annihilation cross section is lower, the rate of the dark matter particle interacts weakly with the medium, then you are going to have a lot more. So if you want to explain the precise content of the universe in terms of dark matter, you have to also explain what is the precise value for this. Because if you have a dark matter particle that with a strong interaction to the standard model, there will be very few dark matter particles around. And we know there is 25% of the universe just dark matter. So somehow the interactions of dark matter to the medium, to the standard model particles, must be kind of weak. And we are going to quantify that. Right? So different values for this cross-section, something that we understand, lead to different values of the relic density. And the relic density is what we observe nowadays. So let me just jump into that. So the relic density of dark matter, this guy, is actually proportional to the inverse of the rate of interactions. That makes sense. And for example, if you talk, let's take something typical, Thomson scattering. So we are just doing what I said, dark matter to a standard model, elastic interactions. So you look at Thomson scattering, there's going to be, because as the coupling of the dark matter particle to the standard model to the fourth over the mass of the dark matter particle square. All right? So our relic density, the experimental constraint, goes as the, at least for elastic interactions, the mass of the dark matter square over the coupling of the dark matter particle to the fourth. So what it means is that we just have one number, right? We know what is the relic density. And we have many combinations that could explain this number. What is tantalizing, if you will, what is great, is that if you take mass of the dark matter particle to be order TeV, or electroweak scale. Let's not put TeV, let's say that's electroweak. And you put the couplings of the dark matter particle to the standard model to be order the electroweak couplings, you get the right amount of dark matter. That's called the weakly interacting massive particle miracle. If you want, it is a miracle that just using physics we expect. So we expect new particles at the TeV scale, and we expect those particles to be coupled, that kind of electroweak couplings. Those two guys, lead to the right amount of dark matter in the universe. All right, so that's great, because it means that not only we can explain or hope to explain something about dark matter, it also means that we should be able to produce those particles at the Large Hadron Collider. So they have the right couplings and the right mass. I'm just giving you the common law. Of course, there are many, many models of dark matter and caveats and sectors and whatever you want. I'm giving you the common law, and from that on you can work out the anomalies and the differences. All right. So besides this number, there are other numbers that we can use for dark matter. And those come from direct detection. So if dark matter interacts with the standard model, then it makes sense to build a detector, some kind of device, that just has a lot of targets of a standard model particle, the only thing we can do, and waits for a long time and tries to discover the interactions of dark matter with the standard model. Those are experiments like CDMS or Xenon. Those are the latest experiments that are setting bounds on the dark matter particles. So what they do is precisely that. They sit down and wait and wait and wait, and so far we see nothing. So from the negative results from these experiments, and many others, but those are the most important ones, from the negative experiments, then we can deduce a bound on the mass of the dark matter particle versus the interaction, cross-section, of the dark matter particle with the standard model. Because we see nothing, it cannot be that the dark matter particle interacts a lot with our nuclei. And that's what they do. So what they do is to write down something like this, cross-section versus mass, and I'm going to show you, I'll do something bigger. So the experiments are looking for nuclear recoil. What is the typical energy for nuclear recoil? Like it's nuclei that goes to the excited state and then goes back. We have a feeling of what is the typical energy. It's kilo electron volt type of energy. So of course the experiments will have the best sensitivity for this kind of mass of dark matter particles. So you look at this kind of exclusion plots, the best sensitivity, this is in so the minimum, the best they can do in these experiments is to rule out cross sections in units of centimeter squared that are over there 10 to the minus 45. A very, very, very tiny cross section. They are really giga electron volts, 10 to the 9.
Did you mean GeV? No, you said KV.
No, sorry. What I mean is that the nuclear recoils is all the KV. Yes, but right. They actually...
I'm confused. So you've got 100 GeV is where the best sensitivity is there.
Yeah, I probably did a mistake. Maybe. I should look at the paper again. So there is a very recent paper by Xenon with this kind of plot. Thank you. And then they can go all the way to 10 to the minus 39 centimeters squared. And this limit over here is of order 10 to the minus 42. Yes. So if the dark matter particle had a very large cross section, we would have seen it. We haven't seen it, so it must be below that. And below that means it's related to what is the mass of the dark matter particle, because it changes the kinematics. Right, okay. So that's it for this part. Any questions about dark matter? The bottom line is that it is there. It's probably a particle. It could be a WIMP particle, weakly interacting particle. It's great. Great first test for physics. But the experiments of direct detection like CDMS and xenon are already imposing such strong constraints on this part, on this type of physics, that even the WIMP miracle seems to be in danger. So we are really in a very bad issue state for the WIMP idea, because we should have seen it already, and we didn't. So that's calling for new ideas for dark matter. Maybe it's not one particle, but it's a sector. Maybe it's not what we thought it was. There is a kind of clash between the WIMP, the WMAP data, and our idea for the WIMP, and the direct detection. So if CDMS and xenon keep getting data out and being more and more precise, and we seem to find nothing, and this is disappointing, because if the WIMP idea was correct, we should have seen something already. But you can, instead of being disappointed, you can think, oh, wow, it's great, because I'm a young person, I can come out with a solution for that. What it seems to be is not so easy as we thought. That's good. All right. So now, let's move on from dark matter. Let's go to another evidence of beyond the standard model. This evidence is the matter antimatter asymmetry of the universe, or also called variogenesis. The WIMP miracle is in trouble because if you just estimate the electroweak couplings and mass of order TeV, should be right there, and we haven't seen it. No, because if you look at the kind of plots, so of this like this. Well, actually, the WIMP idea was already in trouble when I was a PhD student a decade ago. Right? Like you had these plots of typical supersymmetric particles in Suga, and the allowed region was like this tiny. But now with this CDMS really killed, I wouldn't say killed the idea, but it's really putting a lot of trouble. Because you will expect a dark matter particle of order TeV, 10 to the 3 or so, and you will expect some cross-section of this order. So for the simplest ideas are really ruled out. We are, at least in supersymmetry, we are pushed to a corner in the parameter space. So it's great news for new physics, but bad news for the old people that did this WIMP miracle. Questions? No? Okay, variogenesis. So it is as simple as matter is made up of protons and electrons. And if you believe that CPT invariants, do you know about CPT? Charge, parity, if you believe that this is invariant, then antimatter, which is made up of antiprotons and positrons, should be treated equally. And it isn't. There is almost no antimatter around. Oh. Question for beyond the standard model. Now, do we believe in CPT invariants, and do we know something about CPT invariants? Well, we know a lot. We know that CPT is just assuming that it's some quantum field theory with Lorentz invariants plus some assumption about locality. So, if you believe in these guys, there is CPT, but also experimentally, there are very strong constraints on CPT violation. The best constraints come from the Kaon system. So you know that the Kaon anti-Kaon oscillate, and if you describe these oscillations accounting for some CPT violation, the terms that violate CPT are constrained to be for the 10 to the minus 4 or 10 to the minus 5 in crappy units. It's a dimensionless quantity. So you want to learn more about CPT violation constraints or any experimental data, go to the particle data group webpage. They have very nice reviews, including one in CPT violation. Okay, so we know if there is CPT violation, it better be very, very small. And there are a lot of experiments going on trying to come up with some violation of CPT, including forming antimatter, producing stable antimatter and letting it decay and see what's going on, and see if there are any properties in antimatter that are different from matter. For example, they are trying to trap antihydrogen and study antihydrogen and see if it behaves as hydrogen. It's very far along the way, but, you know, it's there. So, okay, so if we believe in CPT, or we think CPT is conserved to a very good extent, then how come we end up with a universe that is maximally CPT violating? Us. And thank heavens, because if there was the same amount of matter and antimatter, there wouldn't be structures, there wouldn't be stable matter, because we would be annihilating all the time. So we need this matter-antimatter asymmetry to produce the universe as we know it. Okay, so first we want to know how much antimatter is around, or how bad it is. How bad? We want to know what is the number of baryons minus the number of antibaryons in our universe. And because it's our universe, and we are going to obtain this information from WMAP, we need to again talk about commoving volumes. All right. First thing you need to know is that the entropy, total entropy, in a commoving volume is conserved. Commoving volume. Meaning that this is equal to zero. So if I define little s, the entropy density, to be the entropy divided by the commoving volume, then that tells you that the entropy goes as the volume to the minus 1. So you want the entropy density is also a measure of the volume itself. Why am I telling you this is because the way we describe the number of baryons minus number of antibaryons is actually using this little entropy. Because now n was the number of particles per commoding volume. But now we can write it as n times s. So if what I want is the number of baryons minus number of antibaryons, it's just this. So if I have access to this quantity, I know how much matter versus antimatter there is in the universe. All right, so we know a lot about it from WMAP again. The cosmic microwave background is great. It gives us a lot of information. So from WMAP, we don't know the number of baryons minus antibaryons over S. Actually, what we know from WMAP is this, number of photons. This is called eta, and this is of order 10 to the minus 10. So between the number, the density of photons and the entropy, there is just a simple relation, actually. So the number of photons is of order the entropy divided by 7. So talking about entropy or talking about photons is the same up to one number. So when we look out in the universe, we see very, very, very little amount of antimatter, although our laws of physics are CPT invariant. So how can that be? it seems hopeless, but actually there is a way out. And the guy that came out with this idea, called Sakharov, like in a paper of 100 years ago, he said, okay, if I have a situation where the laws of physics are CPT invariant, I can still produce dynamically a variant asymmetry if three things happen. First thing, I need variant violation. I need to violate variant number, otherwise there is no variant change. Okay, that sounds okay. I need to violate C, charge conjugation, and also CP.
N gamma is asymptotic to S over 7?
So the number, the density of photons nowadays and the entropy are related more or less by, this is 702, some numbers. So you can compute what is the relation between the density of entropy and the of photons, and it happens to be very similar to each other, just a factor. The reason why is that, I can explain to you, but it will take very long. Is that to tell you that although we are looking after the number of variants versus the entropy, having this number is also very good. Just tells you exactly the same information. So, okay, Sakharov said, we need first variant, variant violation. We need C and CP violation. But even if you have these two things together, nothing you can do unless you get out of equilibrium. So in a universe, in interactions that produce variogenesis, if those interactions are in equilibrium, no matter how much variant violation you get and CP violation you get, this asymmetry will be wiped out because we are in equilibrium. So you need the three things at the same time. And I'm going to explain why if I have 5 minutes. All right. So it was really a very nice idea to come up with the conditions to obtain variogenesis. It's kind of evident why you need variant violation. How are you going to produce an asymmetry in variant number if you don't have any violation of variant number? Okay. So that's evident. What isn't evident is these other two conditions. So if charge conjugation was fine, there was no violation. So imagine that we have processes that goes from initial to final, and there is a violation of variant number in those processes. Let's say, for example, particle X interacts with particle X and produces antiparticle X, and those guys have variant number, so this process, initial to final, violates variant number. So let's imagine that's the situation. But now, if charge conjugation is still there, then it means that we have initial and final, and charge conjugation is telling us that the inverse of initial and the charge conjugate of final are also there at the same rate. So in terms of this example, it would mean that we have this process and we have the opposite with the same rate. That means that here we are violating by a number, whatever, 3, 4, 20, whatever you want. But here in this other process, we are violating variant number by the same amount with a minus sign. So at the end of the day, these two processes in equilibrium lead to no variant number. So although you have individual processes that violate variant number, in total you have no variant number violation. Now, if CP is not violated, what it means, and you assume CPT is conserved, it also means that T, time invariance, is okay, it's not violated. So if time invariance is preserved, it means that we have initial going to final at the same rate as final going to initial. And for the same token, I will produce no net variant number. And finally, and this is not simple, if we are in equilibrium, thermal equilibrium, even if there is C violation, CP violation, and variant number violation, we will end up with no variant number, net variant number. So if we are in equilibrium, then we say that the number density in equilibrium goes as exponential of the mass minus the chemical potential divided by T. So if I can have XX going to photon-photon, from this reaction I get that the chemical potential of the particles is equal minus the chemical potential of the antiparticles. But if there is XX going to variant number violating interaction, that means that this is zero. So at the end of the day, when I write down what is the density of particles minus antiparticles, I get zero. So the bottom line is that we know there is this variant asymmetry in the universe. We know that CPT is not violated as far as we know. If there is CPT violation, it's not very large. So it means that we had to resort to the Sakharov conditions, and those are difficult, because anything you fail to do, you will fail completely. If there is no variant violation, of course nothing. C or CP is conserved, you are screwed, and if you are in equilibrium, bad. So it is not easy to obtain biogenesis, and I think I should stop there. We'll see how we do that in the standard model.
Here we are, here are some desks for a model of particles.